of the racist Israeli regime to African people. I'd like to thank our guests today, Matthew Parks and David Hundale, for their insight. Welcome to our Africa Rising section that focuses on interesting events in Africa, from innovations, achievements in science and technology, to art and culture. Today we have Professor Pitike Ntuli, the South African sculptor, poet, writer, and academic. Pitike Ntuli is a living legend. He was at the front line of the struggle against the apartheid regime in South Africa, and these led to his exile. He also continues using the language of art to fight oppression.
I am a soul that emerged from the stench and the gutter of oppression and breathed hope in the atmosphere of despair. Child of a priest and a Sangoma uncle, I traversed the world of spirits through my art.
Thanks for your time, Professor, today. Now, can you tell us more about your activities in art that led to your exile?
It's kind of a very long story. When I was at in high school, I recited an English poem that was very political. Then I was warned not to read any political poems. Then when I did it for the second time, then I was expelled. And then from then on, the security police got interested in me, because we were painting slogans, down with the past laws, down with the white regime. So I drew that attention, and then I was detained a couple of times. And then after that, I realized that I won't live long. So I had to flee first into Swaziland.
Thank you, Professor, for that. Now, let's go to the next question. Briefly elaborate to us on the anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism messages in your works, including poems.
I mean, obviously, because I was censored when I used words, then I decided that I'm going to use the sculpture, and my sculptures are full of signs and symbols. They carry a lot of hidden meanings in them. They can be read at multiple levels. That's what I chose to to do. But for the major big works, the big monuments, like a 20-ton Mandela, those I use granite. And granite is part of the soil, therefore it also is organic, and therefore it links. Even the choice of material itself is, for me, not only aesthetic, it is political as well.
Quite interesting indeed, Professor Ntuli. Now, can you tell us briefly, what is the difference between African art and the Western art?
Whatever we do, how people make art traditionally, in our culture, is totally different from what you're going to get in Europe, because art originally is meant also as a spiritual exercise. They're also part of religion. They are part of exchange of goods, like any material thing, but ultimately they are of spirit. So if spirituality is not in there, then it is just simply a commercial piece without any lasting value.
Well, art is indeed interesting. Now, Professor, you have composed a poem on Palestine. Now, can you recite parts of the poem to our viewers, particularly at this juncture when Palestinians are facing a U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza?
Sons and daughters of Palestine, you walk in the land that is your own, but not your own. They killed a child in Jenin. I went to plant a flower, but already a red flower was growing. I put my finger on the flower. It came back dripping with blood. And with my dripping finger, I drew a map of Palestine and wrote Free Palestine, Israeli generals bombed the cloud. I was there with you in your thoughts when Peseiro, when you sit deep your pen in the eye of your child and write what it sees. If you dip your pen onto a child in Gaza today, what will you see?
Very moving indeed. I would like to thank Professor P.T. Kantuli for his time today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
As the cost of living crisis continues to bite, data indicates that almost 1 in 10 UK households fail to pay their major bill in the months to 10th of November, the highest level recorded since April of 2020. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. According to a major report warning that UK living standards are falling behind comparable rich nations, British workers are missing out on £10,700 a year after more than a decade of weak economic growth. In a damning report on the economy, the Resolution Foundation and the London School of Economics Centre for Economic Performance called for an urgent rethink of economic strategy after 15 years of relative decline. It said a living standards gap worth £8,300 had opened up between typical households in Britain and their average peers in Australia, Canada, France, Germany and the Netherlands. The result of a three-year inquiry by a group of the nation's top academics, business people and policymakers. The study warned that a generation of younger adults were being failed in particular, with 9 million having never worked in an economy with sustained average wage rises. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is preparing for a general election campaign next year, with households continuing to come under strain from the cost of living crisis and the Conservative Party facing heavy fire over their economic record after 13 years in government. With the government trailing the Labour Party in the opinion polls, the Prime Minister recently declared victory on his primary target to halve Britain's inflation rate this year, while hailing tax cuts in last month's autumn statement to ease pressure on working families. In a speech at the launch of the Resolution Foundation and the London School of Economics Economy 2030 inquiry report on Monday, Section 4, the Labour leader Keir Starmer said, firing up Britain's economy will have to become Labour's obsession in government to reverse years of Conservative mismanagement. However, he cautioned that an incoming Labour administration would face huge constraints on increasing spending on public services, with government finances left in a precarious state for years by a lackluster economic performance hitting the exchequer. Labour leader Keir Starmer said, "Anyone who expects an incoming Labour government to quickly turn on the spending taps is going to be disappointed." Responding to the near 300-page report, Ending Stagnation, Labour leader Keir Starmer said the findings from the country's leading economists confirm stark contrast between 2010 and today. Arguing that Britain's standing is diminished, Keir Starmer said growth is stagnant and public services on their knees. He added, "Taxes are higher than at any time since the war, none of which was true in 2010. Never before has a British government asked its people to pay so much for so little." The Resolution Foundation and the London School of Economics report found that existing plans for reversing decline were not serious and had been founded in the belief that world-beating rhetoric automatically translates into a world-beating reality. Chaired by Minoush Shafiq, a former Bank of England deputy governor, and Clive Cowdery, the insurance magnate and founder of the Resolution Foundation, the report warned that household incomes were not on track to reach the peak recorded before the cost of living crisis until 2027 at the earliest. Finding that Britain had been catching up with more productive countries like France, Germany, and the United States during the 1990s and early 2000s, it said progress had gone into reverse since the 2008 financial crisis. If Britain could close its average income and inequality gaps with these countries, it said the typical household would be 25% or £8,300 better off, with income gains of 37% for the poorest families. It said average wages after inflation is taken into account were no higher than before the banking collapse 15 years ago. If wages had continued to grow at their pre-2008 pace, it said the average wage today would be £43,000, rather than the £32,300 of today. Highlighting a gap in performance with comparable rich nations, it said that poor households in Britain were now £4,300 worse off than their French and German counterparts, leaving them struggling to cope with a cost-of-living crisis. However, while warning that the challenges faced by Britain were huge, it said they were not insurmountable. The report, funded by the Nuffield Foundation charity, said the country needed to focus on its services sector, prioritise public and private investment, expand Britain's largest cities, and raise the number of opportunities for higher quality jobs in every town. Torsten Bell, the chief executive of the Resolution Foundation, said, "The task facing Britain is to urgently embark on a new path, a new economic strategy built not on nostalgia or wishful thinking, but on our actual strengths, along with honesty about the scale of change needed and the trade-offs involved. It's time for Britain to start investing in our future." The British newspaper The Independent has also covered this story and tells us more. As the cost of living crisis continues to bite, data indicate that almost 1 in 10 British households failed to pay a major bill in the months to 10th of November, the highest level recorded since April of 2020. According to the Consumer Group, which latest Consumer Insight Tracker research published recently, 9.8% of British households questioned said they had missed or defaulted on a loan, a credit card or housing or household bill payment over the last month. The consumer body Which said its research suggested that as many as 2.8 million households missed a significant bill over that period. It has called on businesses to do more to help with customers who are struggling. Which said 57% of those surveyed reported having to make financial adjustments to stay afloat. These included cutting back on essentials, dipping into savings, selling possessions, or borrowing in order to cover essential spending. One in six, or 16%, said they had skipped meals due to high food costs, while 8% had prioritized meals for other family members, mostly children. Rocio Concha, Director of Policy and Advocacy at Which, said it's hugely worrying that one in 10 households missed essential payments in a single month. With Christmas and colder weather fast approaching, these pressures on household finances are only likely to worsen in the months to come, which is calling on businesses in essential sectors like food, energy and telecommunication providers to do everything possible to help customers get a good deal and avoid unnecessary or unfair costs and charges this winter. Rocio Concha said supermarkets could help to ease the huge pressure on shoppers, especially families and those on low incomes, by offering affordable budget range essentials in their pricier convenience stores.
Aperture.
Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we will follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good, long trip in the winter. Oh. Hi, I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts, Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian Mountains. Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the national heritage list. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant, but you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming. I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian Mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Flat waters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadig Cave. It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Shir Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Berries to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Balochistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts, but I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berries Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berries Village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berries. The villagers moved from Old Berries to New Berries around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berries Wharf. Thank you. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Baluchistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where old Berries used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in new Berries. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Baluchistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course. The main occupation of the people of Berries is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea for their livelihood. Some strike out to the sea in small boats and throw their small nets in to catch fish. Others go out in wooden launches, which could be called the biggest of man-made contraptions. They go out to sea and spend months fishing. These large wooden motorboats are equipped with proper refrigerators and air conditioning for the crew. The fishermen here say they are not happy with their catches in recent years. They say marine life populations have shrunk drastically. The declining numbers of fish in seas and oceans has its cause in different and important reasons. The first reason behind the decrease in the numbers of marine life around the world is the boom in the human population on Earth. The growth in the human population has led to a larger demand for fish and in turn to overfishing by those in the fishing industry. Operations that are carried out via large ocean-going trawlers fitted with radars and other high-tech equipment. Ships that have nets running several kilometers and by means of radars can trap thousands of fish in every attempt in the depths of oceans. In almost every catch, these ships bring home fish weighing upwards of 300,000 kilos altogether. Industrial fishing and the overconsumption of marine life by humans leaves the fish no time to reproduce, pushing many species to the brink of extinction. In a recent survey, researchers at the University of British Columbia found that in half a century, human consumption has pushed down big fish populations by 90%, fish that are in high demand on the market. They have predicted that if serious action is not taken against overfishing by developed countries, all these species of fish will have gone extinct by 2050. Marine life populations are on the decline, which will have dire consequences for humans and the environment alike. The ecosystems of seas and oceans are intertwined with the lives of humans and the environment they live in. They are all very fragile. Iran accounts for only a small portion of the marine life caught around the world. The reasons being high prices, the small share the marine animals have of the Iranian diet, and the absence of advanced fishing vessels in the country. But European countries, the United States, Japan, and many other developed countries play an important role in the destruction of marine ecosystems. They have done more damage to the environment than any other country in the world. And this is a result of a boom in their populations, a change in consumption patterns, and the lifestyle of the people living in those countries. There are two other important reasons that have contributed to the dwindling numbers of marine animals: contamination and global warming. Berris is a very beautiful wharf. It was built at the foot of the Berris Cliffs, offering a spectacular view. Launches and boats return here with their catch of the day to sell their prized sea creatures to the middleman. Beautiful this fellow is. The local fishermen here call it the kilkita in their local dialect. It's so colorful. Unfortunately, she too is still carrying her eggs. They get caught in the fisherman's net in this season. Most of those I've seen were ready to spawn. This is their time to reproduce, but they don't get the chance to do it. They are pulled out of the water along with the thousands of eggs that they are carrying in their abdomens. Poor thing is struggling to get out of my hand. Just look how beautiful it is. So colorful. One of the fishermen gave me lobster and said I could have it, but I'm gonna let it go because it's carrying so many eggs. After my visit to Berris Wharf, I set off on a walking journey along the shores of the Sea of Omaha. Of course, I'll be walking on the cliffs all along. The view from atop the cliffs in Berris is simply matchless. Fortunately, there aren't constructions of any kind up here. The area is an asset for Balochistan and indeed for Iran because of its pristineness. I hope to see the same unspoiled beauties and pristineness the next time I visit this part of my country and its beautiful landscape. I hope more and more tourists come to visit Balochistan. Nature travelers go to places that are pristine and untouched in order to immerse themselves in the peace and quiet that those places offer. Beautiful rocky cliffs are where Berris begins. Those are the shores of Berris, among the most beautiful of our beloved country, Iran. But the bluff along the shore is crumbling into the sea. The waves lap at the walls made up of millennia-old sediments that settled on the bottom of the Sea of Oman that used to cover this whole area. The bluff is capped by a 2-meter-high layer of rock, like the one I'm sitting on right now. It feels like reinforced mortar with all the shells and algae in it, fossils that have been here for thousands, or should I say millions of years. But the layers underneath are weak and brittle, allowing the waves to chip away at them one bit at a time. The green blocks or rocks that you see on the coast are in fact the top layer of the cliff. They used to be up where I am right now. It's going to take the waves some time to turn them into sand and dissolve them in the water. It's about 60 meters down to the foot of the cliff, and as you can see, a huge slice of the cliff has splintered from the rest, or should I say from Berris territory, and will crash into the sea one of these days. So I better cross onto the other side because it's dangerous to stand here. I really don't want to go down with it. This gaping crack here is almost 10 meters deep, but it's very likely for it to be much deeper in other parts. It's too dark for me to see. This is a very dangerous spot.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with Iran's sports champions and medalists of the 2023 Asian Games and the Asian Paragames. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyye on November 22, 2023. Almighty God holds you responsible in accordance with your popularity. The more popularity, capability, and fame you have, the more responsibilities you will be assigned from God. Pay attention to this. This is true for women, men, our youth, and our teenagers alike. Being famous and noticed makes people prone to some mistakes, and you need to pay careful attention to this. Another point I would like to discuss with you, our dear athletes, is that you should be very thankful to God. This physical ability that God has blessed you with, this determination and willpower that you exhibit in the sports competitions, without which victory is not possible, and physical abilities alone are not enough, your physical abilities and determination are all given to you by God. You should thank God and be grateful, since these are all blessings from God.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One should be thankful for every blessing, and if you are thankful, this blessing increases, God willing. So these were the things I wanted to discuss with you. I frequently pray for all the youth and all the athletes. I will pray a special prayer particularly for you, God willing. I will always pray for you. I would also like to say a few words about Palestine. If I want to give a summary to you athletes about recent events, that summary or short sentence is that the Zionist regime was knocked out by the Al-Aqsa flood operation. In other words, Hamas, a group of resistance fighters, and not a government or a country that is well equipped, but a group of resistance fighters, was able to knock out the usurping Zionist regime despite all its resources. That is a summary of what has taken place. Up until today, they have not been able to pull themselves out from under the pressure and disgrace of this defeat.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. You've done for me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Last Tuesday, the Independent High Electoral Commission announced the preliminary results of Iraq's provincial elections. The commission stated that 41% eligible voters cast their ballots on Monday in a climate of anticipation, integrity, and success.
The Independent High Electoral Commission has fulfilled the constitutional entitlement to hold the provincial elections and perform the national duty it was assigned to do in 2023.
The demand of the people is mainly the public services. Me personally, as a citizen, my only demand is to have the basic services that provincial councils can provide.
Results in most of the provinces showed a major leading for the We Build Alliance, led by Hadi Al-Amri, and State of Law Coalition, led by the former Prime Minister Nour el-Malik. The capital city of Baghdad results showed high competitiveness between three electoral lists. Coming in first is Taqaddum Party, led by the former Parliament Speaker Mohamed Al-Halboussi, collecting more than 132,000 votes, while the We Build Alliance came second with more than 131,000 votes, and the State of Law Coalition in third with more than 130,000 votes. As for the city of Basra, Tasmim Alliance, led by the current Basra governor Asad Al-Aidani, won with over 266,000 votes, while the northern city of Kirkuk recorded the highest turnout across all provinces, with more than 566,000 votes, and witnessed the winning of Patriotic Union of Kurdistan with over 139,000 votes.
The results came out as expected. The well-known political forces collected the most votes, and now all eyes are heading towards the post-election stage, where political blocs from alliances decide who will have the biggest share and who will have the capability to assign the governor for Baghdad and other provinces.
From his part, Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani congratulated the political forces and the winners who have gained the confidence of the public. He also stressed that the government has fulfilled its obligations in holding local elections as a national and constitutional entitlement. He also added that provincial councils are an important step to promote the democratic, decentralized approach adopted in Iraq, which gives local governments the ability for budget management and electing governors, all of which can be a major factor in supporting the current development and reconstruction plan the country is undergoing, and likely to draw a positive effect on supporting future projects that the government has planned for each province.
In a climate of anticipation and success, the Iraqi government has fulfilled its obligation to hold local elections, which is a major step in the path of completing the ongoing reconstruction plan in the provinces. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian traveled to Qatar in his fourth visit since Israel's onslaught on Gaza began over 70 days ago. He met with his Qatari counterpart, Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim Al Thani, discussing bilateral ties as well as recent developments in the region.
We talked about the Palestinian issue. We also discussed bilateral relations between Iran and Qatar, including political and economic ties.
During his visit, Amir Abdullahian also met with the leader of Palestine's Hamas resistance movement, Ismail Haniya, to discuss a possible ceasefire in Gaza as the Israeli regime continues its genocidal campaign in the besieged strip.
Hamas officials, who are the main party in this story on behalf of the Palestinian nation, believe that reaching any agreement with Israel is not a real thing in the shadow of the continuation of the killing of women and children. And if the U.S. and Israel are serious about an agreement, they can start dialogue after establishing a ceasefire.
For his part, Haniya said that despite all the relentless pressure from Israel, the resistance has remained steadfast on the ground and has managed to inflict heavy losses on the occupying regime.
The military aggression of the Zionist regime against the people of Gaza is unprecedented, and we are witnessing a massive amount of attacks from air, sea, and land against the residents of Gaza. The Zionist regime and its allies thought they could destroy the resistance and that the resistance would be forced to raise the white flag. But after 75 days of mass killings and war crimes by the Zionist regime, the resistance is still firm and steady on the ground and has inflicted heavy losses on the Zionist regime.
The Iranian foreign minister has stated that his visit came following recent developments that show the whole region is seeking a stable ceasefire in Gaza.
Experts believe that any end to Israel's genocidal war, which has failed to achieve any of its goals in Gaza, only serves the interests of the Palestinian resistance factions. Reaching a truce, however, won't help the Israeli regime to repair its tarnished image after it lost the international support over the atrocities it committed in the besieged strip. Farzana Shuryun, Doha.
Another phase of the current catastrophe that the displaced Palestinians who are taking shelter in the yards of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir el-Balah City are going through is coping with the heavy rain that has hit the Gaza Strip. It just took less than 10 minutes for the tents, which are made of scraps of plastic or fabric, to be flooded completely with water, and for the land to be turned into swamps, obstructing the movement of people. The rainwater has at least half a meter deep and overwhelmed the people inside the tents, soaking all existing clothes and covers, albeit little.
This is my tent. It is made of plastic and has an area of 4 square meters. My family consists of 13 members. We all sleep inside this tent. After it rained, the tent was engulfed by half a meter of rainwater that soaked our clothes and blankets. Thus, we hug each other to warm the children. We will remain steadfast no matter what happened.
It was just a matter of a few seconds for the people here to realize that they are trapped between the hardship of having access to the basic humanitarian needs and the demolicious rainy weather. Civil defense crews, who are totally overwhelmed with attempts to recover bodies from the rubble of houses destroyed by Israeli strikes, rushed to help the people, despite the lack of needed equipment.
The people here are living in tents which were totally flooded with rainwater because these tents are not designed or prepared to endure this heavy rain. Despite the lack of the needed equipment, we managed to help the people using some primitive means. However, these tents need to be rehabilitated in order to provide protection against the harsh winter.
It's worth mentioning that at least 4,000 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children, have been taking shelter at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital since the Israeli forces launched a ground offensive in the northern part of the Gaza Strip and in Gaza City.
This is another dark side of this continuous suffering for the displaced Palestinians here in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. It is unfolding with the continuous heavy rain. The people here are living inside tents which are not designed or established to protect them from this kind of unprecedented situation. This is a continuation of the distress that the Palestinian people here are experiencing. Muti Abu Musabbeh, middle area of Gaza Strip.
Yemen's armed forces have announced successful attacks on military targets in occupied Palestine. According to a statement by Yemen's armed forces, the latest attack saw a large number of drones targeting military sites and installations in the occupied city of Rashrash, which Israel calls Eilat. The latest attacks come just one day after Yemen's armed forces once again targeted two Israeli ships in the Red Sea. The two ships were destined to unload shipments in the port of Rashrash.
The Yemeni armed forces, with the help of God Almighty, carried out military operation against sensitive targets in the Rashrash area in southern occupied Palestine with a large batch of drones. The Yemeni armed forces confirmed the continuation of their military operations against the Zionist entity until its aggression against our steadfast brothers in the Gaza Strip stops.
Over the past month, Yemen's naval and armed forces have captured or attacked several Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea. The continuous Yemeni attacks have caused some shipping firms to pause Red Sea shipments and travel. Yemen says it will continue to target Israeli-linked or Israeli-bound ships until food and humanitarian aid enters Gaza.
The Yemeni armed forces would like to ensure that all ships and international shipments will be safe to travel to all ports except for Israeli ports. These ships must always keep their naval navigation system on. The Yemeni armed forces will not hesitate to target any ship that refuses to follow these instructions.
According to Israeli financial experts, the Israeli economy has suffered an approximated $4 billion in loss due to the Yemeni blockade on all Israeli shipments.
Israel has called on the U.S. to take military actions against Yemen in order to secure its shipments in the Red Sea. But after witnessing the military capabilities of Yemen's armed forces, neither Saudi Arabia nor the UAE or any other country dares to attack Yemen. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Turkish doctors, medical students, and healthcare workers gathered in Istanbul on Saturday for a silent march against the Israeli regime's attacks on hospitals and medical staff. The protesters lamented that the Palestinian health workers are struggling to save the lives of the victims of the attacks on Gaza amid lack of medical supplies, anesthesia and fuel due to the Israeli blockade on the strip.
We choose to march silently as medical professionals. We are doing this for 4 weeks. Inshallah, it will be fifth week in here. We are doing this in 36 different cities in Turkey and 26 different cities all around the world. For example, in London, in Chicago, Sydney, Kuala Lumpur, Paris, etc. We try to raise our voice against to targeting the healthcare professionals in Gaza, the targeting the hospitals, because as a doctor, the first goal is primum non nocere, because do not harm to anyone. But in Gaza, the forces are targeting medical places directly, so we try to raise our voice against it.
The march was held in collaboration with the Healthcare Workers for Palestine, a collective of healthcare workers who stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. It also held similar marches in 26 cities around the world. The march was also held in 36 cities in Turkey. Demonstrators wore lab coats with red handprints on them to highlight the plight of Gazans and the struggle of the region's healthcare.
Our job is about people's lives. We are trying to save the people's life, and Israel killed the people. And we are all against the killing of people. We are all against the genocide in Palestine. And we will be here until the genocide stops, and we won't stop talking about Palestine.
The protesters carried banners saying the targeting of hospitals and medical team is a war crime. So far, Israel has killed more than 280 medical workers, including doctors, and rendered many hospitals unusable in Gaza. I am a doctor, not a target. This is the slogan used by Turkish doctors and medical field workers, who gave assurance that they will press ahead with their protests until a ceasefire is reached. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Rome hosted a new conference on the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The initiative, dubbed How to Get Rid of a Population, was named after former professor of European contemporary history at the University of Turin, Diana Carminati's eponymous book. Carminati's thesis in her recently published book was that the basic dynamics at work in Palestine are the same as those in US, Canada, and Australia history. These three countries and Israel are all, quote, settler colonial nations, and their plan since the one of the